And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. You know, one of the frequent guests I've got here on Power of Prophecy is a gentleman named Victor Thorne. He keeps writing these books, and I think he just has a very intellectually curious mind. But this book I found very striking. It's entitled Conspirality. It's a combination, of course, of the words conspiracy and reality, all to become one word, conspirality. And it's not just a book about many conspiracies, because he does cover them in here, and it's just great information. But Victor also has a discussion about something called synchronicity. You know, when you start, you know how it is, folks. Now, all of you know this, and that listen to Power of Prophecy Radio and Tex Mars. You know, once you're attuned, let's just call it attuned, I don't know what other word it would be. Once you're in alignment, you studied conspiracy, then the whole world opens up. You know, it's like Winston Churchill said that everybody at one time or another in their lives comes face to face with the truth, and it knocks you down. It just shocks you. You're surprised by the truth. But he said most people just get up, dust themselves off, and go about their way as if nothing happened. But some people, it changes them. When they discover that there are conspiracies in the world, they're real, and that their leaders are part of this great conspiracy movement, sometimes unwittingly, but nevertheless, they're part of it. And the whole world is not what it seems. They're changed. And I believe a person becomes a better man or woman when this change takes place, because then they listen to their TVs and they judge for themselves. Is that person telling the truth or not? Is that president or congressperson? He's just a liar. He's a fraud. He's a fake. And you know it. You know that they're a fake. You know that they're attempting to deceive you. You're not going to be a part of let's just call them the ignorant crowd. Most of them are out there. You know, we laugh at Jay Leno Waters World there on Fox News, who go around interviewing people, and, well, people just seem to be just, to use a Spanish word, estupidos. They're just out of it. And, you know, there are a number of people in this world that don't even really know who Joe Biden is. They never did know who Dick Cheney. They still don't. Many barely know who the president is. But thank God you're not one of those. And because you understand conspirality, well, it makes all the difference in the world. Victor Thorne, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
Thanks for having me on, Tex, and it's always great to be on your show. And I do have to say before we start that I was telling you before the show I got your newsletter yesterday for Robot Alchemy, and I never read a newsletter so quickly or so adamantly as the one yesterday. I can't wait to get my copies in the mail and read the whole book, but this is exciting stuff. So, you know, you're still doing great, great work on your end, too.
Well, you know, I sort of knew a man like you would appreciate that. That kind of a book, Robot Alchemy. Even my wife said, that's a little far out in text. I said, well, no, it's really not, because we're within our lifetime, in fact, maybe 10 to 15 or 20 years of the whole world changing dramatically through robot alchemy. And so I'm giving people a little heads up on it, maybe, although we're already into the world of robots with drones. You know, the Defense Department is spending billions of dollars at DARPA to develop these robot death machines. It's going to affect every one of our lives. And it'll suddenly be upon us, and we won't even know what happened. Well, I want the followers of Power of Prophecy to know what's going on. Well, now, you've written a great book here, and let's spend the rest of the time talking about conspirality. You know, I tell you, Victor, it seems like you have some kind of an uncanny talent in discovering these kinds of things. What motivated you to write this book?
Well, it's a very basic, or most basic, I guess, is it seems more and more so, Tex, that when we tune into the mainstream media, they have a real penchant for talking about conspiracies now. Now, of course, they never talk about them in a favorable light. It's like, oh, those conspiracy theorists say this or that. But it's becoming more and more prevalent all the time. And at its most simple, conspiracies are real, conspirality. And when you hear people saying, oh, well, that's just a conspiracy theory, you have to ask yourself, well, what is a conspiracy? What is it? And it's simply an agreement between two or more people where they agree jointly or engage jointly in an illegal or wrong act. It's that simple. That's what a conspiracy is.
Must be 1,000 conspiracies every day on Wall Street, huh?
Oh, if you go to your local workplace, if you go to a township council meeting, there's conspiracies there.
That's true. You know what's going on. This guy's given money beforehand and padded this guy's pocket to get a project or whatever. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so this is small fries. Imagine if there's billions, or now in this modern era, trillions of dollars at stake. Do people really think conspiracies don't exist? Because if they happen at the very smallest level, it would only make sense that they happen at the macro level too. So that's how I started this book, on that premise. But then it seems like every time I start these books that this concept of synchronicity weaves its way through it. And I know that a few months ago or last year we talked about New World Order assassins and how there was this thread that ran through every chapter, and even things that don't seem to be related, after you read the whole book, you're like, well, yeah, chapter 12, it relates right back to chapter 1, that the same people that are here are also acting over there. So, you know, we have synchronicity in that case, in that regard, but also in our personal lives, and I think you touched upon it nicely in your intro, where how many times have your listeners been going through their day, and all of a sudden they go, oh my gosh, I can't believe that has happened. You know, you're talking to one person, and all of a sudden it brings up something that seems totally unrelated. And that's what synchronicity is. It's really just a coincidence that extends beyond mere chance, that it's beyond probability that this coincidence happens. And, you know, that's synchronicity.
Well, you know, one of the things you talk about in chapter one, and talking about synchronicity, is that there's like a rabbit hole, you know, like a Alice in the Wonderland concept, where you open the portal or the door and you go in, and there's this rabbit hole, and you suddenly you're conveyed downward into the rabbit hole, and the deeper you go, conspiracies just pop up. And I believe that's what happens to conspiracy researchers. Once they understand, once they've entered the portal, they're in the rabbit hole, and then they begin to see all these things and understand it all, and it can be very overwhelming to people, can't it?
Yeah, and I, that's a perfect word you used, portal, because a portal is a doorway. So once I like the old saying that you can't unring a bell. Once people take that first step and understand conspiracies and conspiracy theory, then they understand, like, I'll never see the world the same again. And I know personally how many different people in my life that, you know, I say, hey, you ought to look into this. And, you know, years later, they're completely different people. They're more understanding of the world. They just change, you know. So the synchronicity, when it relates to conspiracies, is it goes beyond cause and effect. And basically, two seemingly unrelated events will occur simultaneously or connect in your mind. And when they do so, they have a bigger meaning. So what it is that it increases a person's wisdom, their understanding of the world, and these synchronicities give added meaning. So it really extends beyond, I guess, the constraints that not only we put on ourselves, but also the education system, the mainstream media, the government, all of these different things. They like to keep us in the box. okay? Mm-hmm. And when you use the word portal, is what we've done is we say, we don't want to be in this box anymore. We're going to go out through this doorway and look at the world for ourselves. We're going to make our own decisions. And, you know, I even, in the last year or so, been studying a lot of quantum theory. And I even tie the synchronicities to that, because what you basically have in our existence is these things called wave functions and particle functions. And I don't want to get too deep into that, but what it is a wave function is the non-physical. And when that collapses through observation, then you have the particle function, which is the physical world. So a synchronicity, these happen all the time. But the only time that it can be realized is when we observe it. So it's like quantum theory, where the wave function only becomes actual when it's observed. So I hope I'm not getting a little too technical, but, you know, I see this stuff now in such a different light. I view the world in such a different light now that, you know, it just keeps expanding outward for me.
Well, let's just take an example of something that happened to me, but it could have happened to you too. I read about a guy named Jerry Garcia. His music group was the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. Now, they're big back in the 60s and 70s, and they're a big, you know, bunch of dope heads, long hair, this Grateful Dead rock group. Of course, the name itself, the Grateful Dead, you know, gives you a clue that they're into the death thing. But they were very popular, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. Now, you know, I found it sort of disgusting, but I noticed that a lot of people into that sort of found it really fascinating. And Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead went on this rock tour of the United States and had quite a large following. Now, recently, I discovered that Jerry Garcia was a paid CIA agent. He was being paid, and the Grateful Dead were being paid by the CIA. Now, all of these hippies and all the others hated the CIA, hated the establishment, but there they were. You know, a bunch of followers, groupies of Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. They would go around from town to everywhere he was at. They would go there, never realizing that it was all a CIA thing to see. Now, the CIA also injected LSD in it, okay, and of course, pot. So the pushing of the hallucinogenic drugs and the LSD and everything by Garcia and the Grateful Dead was all a CIA project. Then suddenly I'm at the dental clinic of all places, right? Now we're talking about, you know, things just happening to you. And there was a big article about Al Gore and Tipper Gore, his wife. And it said that Al Gore actually wasn't a bad guy. Why, his favorite group of he and Tipper's was the Grateful Dead. And it showed him at a recent Grateful Dead concert. And it said he has a whole assortment of ties. Hallucinogenic, you know, looking ties, you know, all the artwork just sort of flows together by Jerry Garcia, because Jerry Garcia sold all these ties, and Al Gore loved these ties. Of course, we know that Al Gore, you know, is also working with the CIA in a little production. His father's a U.S. senator and all this. It sort of expands, doesn't it? You have Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. You have the CIA. Rolling Stone magazine. Okay, a rock magazine prints a favorable story of Al Gore and Tipper Gore and their ties to Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. Well, now, Tipper, of course, appeared to be a, would you call it a moralist who wrote a book talking about the dangers of rock music for kids.
Yeah, I remember that, Parents Resource Center or something. Yeah,
exactly, of course. You know, she was, you know, that was all part of the plan to get Al Gore into the White House. So she was writing books warning kids about, you know, rock music, but she and Al Gore are going to this rock music concert by one of the worst groups. And so the CIA and all of these things all come together in one big pot, one big brewing witch's brew, don't they?
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting, because what that sounds like with Jerry Garcia is something that was called Operation Chaos, which was a CIA program that actually Hillary Clinton was also involved in the late 60s, during her time at Yale. And what Operation Chaos was is they took seemingly countercultural figures like Jerry Garcia or Hillary back when she was, remember when she was all hippie looking with her feminist granny glasses and everything? Well, what they do is they take these figures and then they use them to infiltrate the left and collect information about what's going on. So for Jerry Garcia, who would be a better figure to have on the CIA payroll than him going to all of these different concerts with the Deadheads? And I mean, I know people that adore the Grateful Dead, and I always thought them to be boring as heck because it's like you sit there in the mud for 3 hours listening to these guys just play 50-minute-long guitar solos and stuff. It just bores you to tears. But yeah, it makes perfect sense, Tex, under that Operation Chaos. And when you tie in then Al Gore to it, you know, people would think, how does Al Gore tie up with Jerry Garcia? But there it is, synchronicity. Two seemingly unrelated events all of a sudden now have an expanded meaning in someone's mind because of this union between them.
Yeah, and I doubt very seriously that Al Gore really lacked his ties or his music or anything else, but his wife there, they were at a big concert. So it was part of the plot, the pushing him for the youth and all this kind of stuff. But it just shows you how you can get everything all involved in one big witch's brew. And all these, you know, you might say that all of these people are involved in one way or another in a small way with conspiracy, but maybe none of them really knew what was going on. Certainly the hippies, that are there at the concert, you know, they're just ignorant druggies. They have no idea at all, about these things. Well, would you call it the law of attraction, synchronicity, that, you know, you get involved in something and you find out how widespread it is, or what would it be called here? The law of attraction or what?
Law of attraction, other people call it intentionality. And you had another good analogy, how if a person opens themselves up to this. So with synchronicity, if you open yourself up to various forces that aren't normally accepted in what we call consensus reality, again, the box that's been created for us, then what you can do is enter into a different dimension or a different mode of thought, and this law of attraction or intentionality means that you're basically creating then the type of quote-unquote reality that you want instead of this reality being created for you by somebody else. So I think it's a great way to put it, Tex, because what do we as human beings want? Do we want to create for ourselves the type of existence we want, or do we want them? And when I say them, we mean the New World Order elite. Do we want them to be creating our existence for us? Well, none of your listeners are going to say them, that's for certain. And so we really almost like, if you have this fabric of consensus reality, what we're doing is just ripping a hole in it or ripping a fissure in it and saying, no, we're not going to allow you to define what our existence is or our world or how we think. We're going to do it for ourselves. And once you take that step, your whole world changes. It empowers that person. And instead of being a victim, you're now someone that determines your own future and your own potential.
You know, there is a great danger in this. Now, I'm a Bible-believing Christian, and let me tell you my experience over the years is when a person seeks out, becomes a seeker, looks to the supernatural, into the occult world, then they become trapped in that reality, in that occult existence. For example, I think Malachi Martin, the former Jesuit priest, you know, I wouldn't recommend him because I personally think the guy was involved with various intelligence agencies and such. But he did write an interesting book called Hostage to the Devil, in which a man had demon spirits in his body. And as he was driving along, you know, Highway 101, or is it Highway 1, I think, there on the coast, Malibu coast of California, he began to talk to his demon, literally carried on a conversation with a demon that was inside of him. And he said, why me? Why have you chosen me? Because the guy was miserable. He was possessed by devils. And the devil told him, said, you wanted me. You wanted us. And the person who was possessed says, when did I ever ask you to come into me, into my existence? And the devil said, oh, you wanted us. Do you remember the time you went to that Ouija board? You played the Ouija board. And do you remember the time you went to the, to that fortune teller? And she brought out her crystal ball and all these things. Oh, we were there. You wanted us. And we possessed you. Because there are not enough devils in the world to possess every human being. So, you know, when people get involved in these things, it is the law of attraction. You know, when you go to a seance, when you go to, I have a young lady who came to me and she said, I'm just drawn to satanic things. She said, in my apartment, I have a picture, and it shows a demon skull coming up out of water. And I just had to put that on the wall. And then she said, they have all of these demon festivals here in Austin, Texas. And I love to go to them. I don't know why. I'm just drawn to them. And, I perceive that the young lady was possessed by devil. So I do want to mention that to people that the law of attraction, if you approach it from a true Christian standpoint, you know, that's acceptable. I think you need to ask the Lord, what do you want me to do? Some people cannot handle it at all. But talking about conspiracy in general, I think that's acceptable. That's perfect. I think God wants us to know things. You know, even Daniel 12:10 says
that you, you know, really give people this cautionary tale, because it is easy to go into realms that are dangerous, to say the least.
Right.
So, yeah, we do that cautionary tale. People need to be reminded of that, because you know, as you said, once you ring a bell, you can't unring it. And if you're ringing it in the wrong places, that's not where you want
to be. Right. Yeah. So that's all I would say, because, you know, people can think, oh, well, Texas saying it's good to go check into all these things. I think we ought to be very careful and, you know, pray about it and make sure it's what God wants. But that's true of anything in our life. We should operate our life that way. Now, let's grill Victor Thorne a little bit, okay? I know you're a guy that loves to be grilled on things.
Sure.
And you're always ready. Well, you know, you talk about Pat Tillman in this book, the Norway Massacre. You go back to the Lusitania. Richard Nixon, he's always my favorite. Watergate and the Fed. Stanley Kubrick, the moonshot. Even Patty Hearst. I mean, wow, incredible things. Let's talk about, say, Pat Tillman.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about Pat Tillman, what you perceive in the poor guy. Of course, he's passed away now, but he was killed over in Afghanistan. What do you see there?
Pat Tillman was one of the legitimate tragic stories of the last decade, and here he was, a professional football player. I believe he played for the Cardinals. Here's a guy that was making millions a year. And after 9/11, he sadly, at least initially, believed the official story that, you know, these 19 cave dwellers under the tutelage of Osama bin Laden came to America and attacked us. And he was so patriotic and wanted to do what was right for his country that he gave up millions of dollars a year and enlisted in the military. And he went over to Afghanistan with his brother, and he was fighting Al-Qaeda and Taliban over there. So once he got there, though, he saw the other side of the coin, and he realized that one of the major things the United States was doing over there, specifically the CIA, because the CIA set up that war, not even the Pentagon. The CIA was the first ones into Afghanistan. And he realized that a lot of his time was spent in Afghanistan guarding the opium fields.
Mm.
I said, opium fields? I thought we were fighting terrorists. No, he was standing around him and his colleagues guarding the opium, and as it was picked, as it was packed, as it was transported, and it was shipped out of Afghanistan. And Pat Tillman, even though he was a football player, people think, oh, you know, he's just some dumb jock. He wasn't. He was well-read. He kept a diary for all of his life, ever since he was a child. Mm. And he was getting ready to end his tour of duty, and he started contacting some people back in the States and setting up interviews. So when he was done, he was going to come back over here and talk about his time in Afghanistan. Well, before this, he was the poster boy for George Bush and Dick Cheney's war on terrorism.
Oh, yeah.
But they started getting wind of this. And they're like saying, oh, my goodness. If he comes over here and starts talking about opium, I think we're going to have some problems on our hands, especially when he's going to be the most celebrated ex-soldier in the whole U.S. military. So, readers have to get this book just for this chapter alone, because it's one of the saddest in the book, and when readers really understand how Pat Tillman died, it's going to break their heart, because this guy was a hero. This was a guy that did things for the right reason, and he ended up coming back in a body bag, Tex. And when you read what happened to this guy, it's sad.
Just plain murder, wasn't it?
It was plain murder, is right. Yeah, and it's, Yeah, it's yeah.
Evidently, so he was going to become a peacenik, but a legitimate one. I mean, he was going to tell people the truth. They would have believed the guy for at least a while till the media smeared him, because he was the poster boy.
Yeah,
I mean, they loved when he went. They put out all the pictures of him in uniform and everything. I mean, every young boy in America said, hey, I want to be like that. I'm going to go be like Pat Tillman. He's my hero. It was an astonishing blow to the administration. So rather than confronting all of that, they just decided to undercut it and just do away with the guy, waste him.
Well, they had to silence him. His voice, because he would have had a powerful voice and a voice that would have made it to CNN, to Fox News, to ABC, NBC, CBS. He would have been on all of these big shows. And if he was mad, Tex. He was disillusioned with this, because he went over there and thought, I'm going to be G.I. Joe. I'm going to be like the World War II movies that I saw as a kid. And they go over there and he says, these guys are dealing drugs over there. That's the main reason we went into Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan's the most desolate country on the face of the earth, and the only thing it's good for, that it's very good for, is it's good for growing poppies. It's good for growing the base product that's used for opium, which becomes heroin. And there's so many pictures. I've written numerous articles about it, but there's pictures online. Anyone can go and look at them. You'll see huge fields of poppies, and they'll be surrounded by soldiers with helmets carrying their guns, guarding these fields as people come in and pick the crops and set it on its way.
You mean that those aren't flowers? I thought it was like the Holland's tulips.
Yeah,
you know, in
they
season
look,
there.
They're pretty. Look like pretty flowers, but they're poppies.
Well, not only that, but I show in my video "Die America, Die." China, Red China, has 300,000 mining workers that we're guarding and protecting over there. 300,000, bringing up uranium ore, aluminum, tin, all of those things, and of course the oil. So, wow. So Pat Tillman, but his parents know about that. We're going to take a break here. But his parents knew about that, and his brother knew, and they've raised some cane themselves, haven't they?
Oh, they have. They have, and regrettably, their voice hasn't been heard, because if this story got out into the mainstream,
mm-hmm.
this is the kind of stuff that brings down administrations.
Yeah.
This is how powerful this material is. So
exactly.
This is the people who get killed are the people that are an immediate threat to the powers that be, and Pat Tillman was.
Okay, folks, we're listening to Victor Thorne today, his new book, Conspiriality. We're going to tell you how to get this book. Stay with us, won't you? Victor, we'll be right back. Well, Victor Thorne, my good friend, has a new book out here called Conspirality. Folks, you need to get this book. It'll enlighten you about many things that you had questions about. You knew something was wrong, something, you know, had gone haywire, but you didn't know what. And what Victor Thorne does is put all these things together, and you know, he opens up the portal, so to speak, and you get to look in and find out about Pat Tillman, Anders Breivik, the Zionist that killed all those young people in Norway, even why World War I was a false flag incident with the sinking of the Lusitania. Richard Nixon, did he have anything to do in Watergate with the Fed, the Jews? How about Stanley Kubrick? Here's a guy that did a horrible movie called Eyes Wide Shut, full of symbolical significance. I'd like to know what that meant. And did he have anything to do with the moonshot? Or was there even a moonshot? So much in this book, Conspirality by Victor Thorne. Conspirality. Now it's $20. Please add $5 shipping and handling. We'll send your copy. Just ask for Conspirality. If you misspell it, well, we'll understand. I misspell it myself sometime. But it's a great title, Conspirality, all one word, Conspirality by Victor Thorne. $20, $5 shipping and handling, a total of $25. By the way, you can send that $25 to us. Just ask for the book, Conspirality by Victor Thorne, to Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson, Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. You can also go to our website. That's powerofprophecy.com or simply textmars.com. That'll get you there. powerofprophecy.com, and it'll take you then to Conspirality. You can use your charge card or your PayPal and get it online. Conspirality. Let's see, Jerry, there's another way to get it. By phone, of course. They can call 1-800-234-9673. I need Jerry here in the studio to keep me straight, keep me going. Okay, that's 1-800-234-9673. Now let's return to our regular program. Of course, I want to mention to you again that anyone who orders anything from us, we're going to put you on our newsletter list. And you'll stay on it for at least 6 months. You'll get the print copy. Okay? So when you order this book, we'll be glad to give you a 6-month subscription, a print subscription. Of course, you can read our newsletter online at any time, powerprophecy.com, and a lot of other articles too. Interesting things that you maybe not have heard about, or if you did, well, let's just say I'm a big believer in conspiracy science. I don't really believe in conspiracy theory. I have discovered that it's a science. And you'll learn more about conspiracy science by going to powerofprophecy.com. Victor Thorne, welcome back to Power of Prophecy.
Well, it's great to be here. And I have to do plug your newsletter too, Tex, because I think I've been getting it since 1993, if I'm not mistaken, when I moved back east from California and I got your first book and ordered it and was on your newsletter. And I definitely look forward to it every month, and then I pass it along to other people, and they read it afterwards. So, yeah, definitely get on that mailing list, everybody.
Well, thank you very much for that. Okay, let's talk about the Norway massacre. This guy, Anders Breivik, is that his name?
Yes.
He takes guns, assault rifles, I guess you would call them, and he goes there in Norway to this little island. And, wow, how many people did the guy kill?
Well, this is back in July of 2011, and is actually a two-pronged attack, this one. But first, he set off an ANFO bomb, and people think, ANFO bomb? Why does that sound familiar? Oh, yeah, that's what Timothy McVeigh supposedly used to knock down the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. So first, he uses this ANFO bomb, kills 8 people, and injures over 200 techs. Then he drives out to this little island. And it ends up, even though he was cited as the typical lone nut assassin, there was way too much carnage for him to be acting alone. And by all accounts, he killed 69 other people there and wounded over 100 more. So he's up there as maybe the number one mass murderer in the history of the world, or real close to it anyway. And so this was a horrendous act. And what it really was when I wrote this was, it's an extension of a program that began after World War II called Operation Gladio. And Gladio has a lot of ties to 9/11. That's where people started really bringing this topic up. But after World War II, after America won World War II for the Allies in Europe, they were worried about the communists moving into Europe and setting up shop again. So what they would do is set off these little terrorist attacks. And what they would do is blame it on leftists or communists or whatever. And they did what's called a strategy of tension, which is still in existence today. The latest example is up in Boston at the Boston Marathon bombing. But a strategy of tension is basically a technique to keep the populace in fear, always in fear, so then they can look to who? To the government, to come in, swoop down, and be their protector, to save them from whatever danger is at hand. And this has been used, whether it was the fear of the Nazis or fear of the communists during the Vietnam War, or, you know, fear of the Russians during the Cold War. Now it's the war on terrorism. So there's always an Orwellian enemy that's out there that we need, of course, the government to protect us from. So Anders Breivik was a Zionist that he attacked this island because the high school people or people in their late teens that were there, they were holding signs that said, boycott Israel, boycott Israel. And the strategy of tension comes in because he was trying to warn Europe about multiculturalism. And this is a problem that we have in our country, too, with these open borders, you know, down south in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California. And he's saying, look at this way, these waves of Muslims that are coming into Europe. So he was using these two conflicting sides where you have the Muslims on one hand and then he was a Zionist on the other. And when you put these two together, you have a clash of civilizations. And his message was that, you know, we have to become more nationalistic in Europe. And by doing so, he's in prison for the rest of his life and just had a great deal of carnage in Norway.
Well, let's this sort of is confusing. Anders Breivik was opposed to multiculturalism, the Muslims, so many coming in, but he was a confirmed Zionist. He killed for Israel.
Yes.
I mean, and of course, all this was sort of covered up at the time. You know, they didn't want to admit that's what he was doing. Now, how can he really be a nationalist, a Norwegian opposed to multiculturalism, if the guy is a Zionist? I mean, you know, I realize that the Zionists believe they're the only true race that's godlike. They're better than all of us. And, you know, Israel is the God's chosen people, even though now we know that they're Khazars. They're not even Jews. But nevertheless, Zionism itself is a racist doctrine. So they would not accept Anders Breivik at all unless he was a Jew.
That's right. And see, that's what's so enigmatic about Breivik is that he's in this country, and well, through Europe also, it's the Zionists that are promoting multiculturalism. So how could Breivik,
right,
who's a Zionist, be opposed to multiculturalism? And I don't think he had a full comprehension of what Zionism really entailed, but, you know, he was more of the neocon ilk that saw the Zionists as a positive force in the world. And so I believe, Tex, that ultimately this guy was a dupe or a patsy. And, you know, he drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, and went out and did his murderous deeds without really even a full understanding of what it was all about, what it really entailed. Because, you know, when you look at the politicians in this country, the ones that are pushing multiculturalism and liberalism the most is the ones who are often the ones from Israel that are promoting this agenda. So there is this enigma with Breivik that really, you know, throws people for a loop. But at the end, you know, what he did really fit into this strategy of tension, because it created this provocation. He was a provocateur, and it all ends up that anytime we have these type of incidents, there's more of the surveillance state or the police state, or, you know, the Orwellian 1984 that comes down upon us. So in the big picture, it fits in with their agenda.
Now, you mentioned Operation Gladio. Now, this is absolutely true. In fact, I think one of the Italian presidents admitted it. And now, well, anybody can go online, Google up Operation Gladio, and see how this was a huge, all over Europe. I remember reading that even the Red Army in Germany, that was supposedly made up of these pro-communists, the Red Army actually was by the capitalists. You know, we funded it, you know, and there they were in Germany fighting for communism and all that, killing people with bombings and such. But it turns out that they were all pro-capitalist, just trying to stir the pot. And you know, I suppose that was part of the Operation Gladio movement.
Oh, absolutely. And I just wrote a 7,000-word article on the Boston bombing and interviewed a man who I interviewed also for this Gladio article, Vinny Sammartino, who does great work. He's down in Jersey. And he says, how many of the people from Gladio were ever prosecuted? And he said, none of them were. And when you think about it, Tex, how many people were prosecuted for the Kennedy assassination or for 9/11? You know, and I'm talking about the real culprits here.
Mm-hmm.
How many people have been prosecuted for any of these crimes? Well, the answer is none. So it's not surprising that there's a perpetuation of these programs. And what we call it now, today, in the 21st century, is Operation Gladio 2.0, that it's an updated version. And back in the olden days, after World War II, it was the fight against communism. Well, now it's what? The fight against, or the war against, terrorism. So it's, you know, you switch the enemies like Orwell always did, but you keep the same basic philosophy and techniques involved, and it just continues over time.
Well, you keep that fear pot stirring too, don't you? I mean, that you destabilize entire countries. I mean, that have no government. They're just fighting each other, and they're warring, and the terrorist movement's growing inside places like Syria. Iraq now is going back into a state of abject terror. There's no real government in Iraq. It's all, you know, constant bombings back and forth. That's the way we left it. The only thing that has security in Iraq are the oil fields and the pipelines, because we in Israel own those. And we've sold them to Red China. So, boy, you know, but this Breivik is the guy is cold-blooded, wasn't he? He had
cold-blooded, yeah.
They use these monsters that have no conscience. They're psychopaths, don't you think?
Yeah, and he was particularly narcissistic and arrogant, egotistical. And, you know, I think he saw himself as type of like Nietzschean Ubermensch, you know, Superman. And, you know, he wanted to rid Europe of the undesirables as he saw them. And, you know, to go in there, and these are high school kids or kids in their late teens, and to just cold-blooded massacre dozens and dozens of them where, you know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel is what he was doing. And, yeah, he's right where he belongs.
Well, Norway has gun control. You know, they don't they wouldn't allow anybody out there to even have any protection.
Right.
And all of the psychopaths, they love gun control. I mean, you know, that means they can go out and kill as many people, not have to worry about, because they're basically cowards themselves. They don't want to get hurt. But they don't have to worry about it. Gun control has made sure of that. And that's sort of the dangerous part of gun control.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's such a big push ever since the last election with Obama that's really been his number one agenda here lately, is to strip the populace of its weaponry. And, you know, Texas, your state down there, Texas, is at the forefront of saying, no, you're not taking our guns, not a chance. And, you know, there's sadly so many people in this country that are willing and want everyone to give up their weaponry. And, you know, if that happens, I think that's the last vestige of any chance we have of fighting this tyranny, because once we're defenseless, like, you know, after the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, once 600 and some thousand guns were taken away from the citizens, that country's never been the same again.
That's right. And of course, every one of the elite, you know, from Rosie O'Donnell to Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, all of these people, they all have guards, security guards that are under their hire that have guns that protect them. So they're not really, you know, for letting guns go. They have more guns than anybody. You know, they're all protected. Their mansions in Beverly Hills and so forth, they're all protected. So that's sort of the sad part of it is they really are a bunch of hypocrites who want to take away the people's guns while, you know, they have plenty of guns, you know. So anyway, well, let's talk about Stanley Kubrick. Now, Stanley Kubrick was a famous movie director, right?
One of the most famous ever.
What are some of the movies? Tell us a little bit about Stanley Kubrick and why he's included in Conspiriality.
Okay, well, Stanley Kubrick was always controversial. He made Dr. Strangelove. He made Lolita. He made 2001 A Space Odyssey, A Clockwork Orange, one of the most violent films ever made. And he made the film you mentioned, actually the last movie he ever made, Eyes Wide Shut, which exposed one of these big Illuminati sex rituals at a mansion. And there's quite a bit of conspiracy talk that, see, Stanley Kubrick, since he was the elite director, and even Steven Spielberg said years later, he said, wherever the rest of us wanted to go, we always followed Kubrick. So Kubrick was at the front of the pack, everyone else followed. And Kubrick always had an agreement that regardless of what he presented to the studio, they were not allowed to edit it. That's how much cachet this guy had.
Wow.
Last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, where he shows this elite sex ritual, which would be like the Bilderbergs or the Council on Foreign Relations, Bohemian Grove, something like that, that they had a meltdown. And within 3 days after him presenting this film, Stanley Kubrick is dead. Now, has anyone proven he was murdered? No. No one's proven it. But there's a lot of speculation. And what he presented, it was the only film that was ever edited. So what you see on a DVD or what people saw at the theater wasn't the original, what Kubrick presented to them. And I know even my buddy Paul Tepeti, who I'm sure you know, he called me up a couple times. He says, how can we find that lost footage? I said, I don't think we're ever going to find it, Paul. But he's in this book because there's a lot of people that claim he was involved in hoaxing the photographs of the 1969 moon landing.
Stanley Kubrick?
Stanley Kubrick.
Now, when did he die? Wasn't it just a few years ago?
I believe it was it 99? But whenever that movie, whenever Eyes Wide Shut came out, is he died within days after him presenting it. So I can't remember.
Now, that was a horrible movie. It was full of symbols, wasn't it?
And
it
had huge symbols.
Had Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman.
Yep.
You know, sort of played the big parts there. But it had you know, Tom Cruise, of course, is with Scientology, and you well state in your book the connection of the Sea Org, you know, the ship and the Navy, and L. Ron Hubbard, who founded Scientology, had been in the Navy. So Kidman had this sexual fantasy in her mind about a naval officer, didn't she?
That's right, and that, you know, a lot of people think, well, that was L. Ron Hubbard because he was the founder. He dressed like a sea captain all the time, actually lived on a yacht for many years to avoid taxes and prosecution in the States. And what's a lot of synchronicity here, Tex, you brought this up, I didn't even know you were going to, but with Tom Cruise, who's one of the highest ranking members of Scientology, well, there's ties to that. But then it also goes back to L. Ron Hubbard. And then in Conspirality, I also relate how at the Stanford Research Institute back in the early 1970s, the first people that were recruited by the U.S. government to engage in a program that later became remote viewing, every single one of the main characters, including a psychic named Ingo Swann, every one of them was a Scientologist. Yeah. And L. Ron Hubbard then has connections to this guy named Jack Parsons, who they did this experiment where they wanted to create this like almost like an alien baby homunculus is what it's called. And L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons then had close connections with the famous diabolist Aleister Crowley, who was named the wickedest man in the world. So you can see how right here, just within a minute, you can see the synchronicity now that weaves through all of these chapters of the book, and one of them relates back to the next and the other one. And Scientology plays a key role in all this. It's one of the most diabolical, quote-unquote, religions in the world. It's not a religion at all, but
it's
a money-making scam is what it is.
Now, Stanley Kubrick was involved, people say he was, that he was evidently contacted by the CIA or the space people or whatever, mm-hmm. and recruited, and he actually filmed the 1968 walk on the moon when we supposedly landed. And Neil Armstrong said, you know, a small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And all of this stuff, Buzz Aldrin, the 33rd degree Mason, was there. But that we didn't, the contention is that we never went to the moon, but Stanley Kubrick filmed it under contract with the CIA or whoever. He filmed it, and then we get these grainy pictures that we know are, you know, apparently is, you know, nonsense. But they're all kind of anomalies in them. You know, there's problems with the film itself. They've been analyzed back and forth and seem to be fakes in many different respects. But Kubrick, I don't know if you call it credit or whatever, but now personally, I thought at first that's crazy. We had to go to the moon. The whole world thought so. But now I know, no, we didn't go to the moon. We absolutely did not go to the moon. It sounds so fantastic. But here again, there's this synchronicity, isn't there? Because, well, didn't they make a movie about faking, one of the moon shots? And wasn't O.J. Simpson one of the stars? Well, he was an astronaut in the movie.
Yeah, it was called Capricorn One. And the only difference was that instead of going to the moon, they were supposed to go to Mars.
Ah.
So that was how they switched it around. But the premise is exactly the same, where they said, we're not going to make it to Mars. We don't have the technology to do so, so we have to fake it.
Yeah.
That's what we have to do. And Kubrick, see, NASA and the Pentagon became familiar with him when he was making Dr. Strangelove. And he wanted to use one of their B-1 bombers in this film. And they said, absolutely not. You can't use our B-1 bombers. And so what he did was he found all of these technical manuals and magazines with photographs in them, and he pieced them all together and constructed the interior of a B-1 bomber that was so realistic and lifelike that the Pentagon said, how did this guy do it? This guy's a genius.
Mm-hmm.
So they contacted him, and they realized how far beyond everyone else he was. And Stanley Kubrick, even though his name doesn't sound it, Stanley Kubrick was Jewish. So they contacted him and said, look, we're going to make you an offer you can't refuse. We want you to film the scenes that we're going to use in this moon hoax. And initially, Stanley Kubrick thought it was very exciting. I mean, this is the project of a lifetime. But the further he got into it, the more sinister he realized that it was. And obviously, he couldn't come out and tell people about this. He'd be murdered. He would be killed on the spot. So what he did, and what I chronicle in Conspirality, is how he made this movie, The Shining.
Ah, with Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, he hid all of the clues about how he faked the moonshot. And it's an amazing chapter. And once, because, you know, everyone's seen The Shining with Jack Nicholson in it, and you watch the movie, and in all honesty, it's not even a very good movie. But when you now watch it with these eyes wide open, as Kubrick would say, you see the movie in an entirely different light, and you say, now I know what he's trying to say. Because you watch the movie, and there's all these things, they don't make sense.
Yeah.
Well, they do make sense. If you now read this chapter and understand what Kubrick was really trying to tell people, is he was confessing that, look, I'm the one that was behind the camera filming the moonshot.
Yeah, it's just, and of course, we have not gone back. Think of that now. We have not gone back to the moon. It's been 45 years. We have not gone back one time to the moon. And of course, they have now abandoned all hope. And NASA says, no, we're not going to do any more moonshots. So
we have to hitch rides with the Russians now to even get up to the space
the capsule up there.
But
we have no intention to go to the moon. We haven't gone back. We went that one time that apparently was filmed. But it made us look good, boy. And the whole world now thinks that America is so technologically advanced that we went to the moon. So it shows what they can pull off. And how with the Jews really do own the media. We know that. And they have certain things. You can't just walk into the New York Times and say, I've got the story of the century. I'm going to expose it here. The next thing you know, they'll be carting you off. They're not going to expose anything. So you have to understand that. I remember there was a movie, wasn't there? I think it was Robert Redford, Condor. 3 days of the Condor.
3 days of the Condor, yeah.
Yeah, and he finally got to the media. There he was before their building. And that's the way the movie ended. Like he was going to go in and expose it all.
The reporter at the end of that movie, after Redford spills his guts to him, the reporter says, what makes you think we're going to report this?
Yeah, oh, is that right? I must have missed the last scene. Okay.
Yeah, and here's Redford, who stakes his whole life on, you know, getting to the media and exposing these government crimes, and he finally makes it to the reporter, and the reporter's like, what makes you think we're even going to report this?
Ah.
The look on Redford's face is, oh, my God, like, that's how the movie ends.
By the way, Redford is doing another a movie or a TV show now that's called Chicagoland. It's going to make Rahm Emanuel look heroic and a great leader. Redford.
Didn't he just make a movie about one of those, about the Weather Underground? He made a movie.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, a big left-wing liberal, so.
Big left-winger, yeah.
Jerry, how much time do we have here? Oh, 1 minute. Man, I'll tell you, I wanted to talk about, well, folks are going to have to go to the book. I guess we need to leave something for readers. The Conspirality by Victor Thorne. Please, folks, for $25. That's postpaid. And go to powerofprophecy.com or call us here 1-800-234-9673 or write to us Power of Prophecy 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas 78733. Victor, it's been my pleasure to have you today. Thank you for coming on Power of Prophecy.
Well, thank you and Jerry and everyone else down there at Power of Prophecy, and especially to all your listeners. And it's always one of my favorites to come down and talk with you a little bit. So thanks to everybody.
Well, thank you again, you know, and keep putting out these books because I think people are really awakening all over the world. People are beginning to awaken to the truth of this. Who knows, maybe God willing, there'll be a tipple point. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but at least we're awake and that's good. Well, thank you, Victor.
Thanks, Tex.
And folks, until next time, next week, please tune in and discover the power of prophecy.